Welcome to Education Perspectives. I am your host, Liza Holland. This is a podcast that explores the role of education in our society from a variety of lenses. Education needs to evolve to meet the needs of today and the future. Solving such huge issues requires understanding. Join me as we begin to explore the many perspectives of education. Allison Sloan has been a special education teacher since January of 1999 in the Rowan County school system. She is also the administrator and founder of Kentucky Teachers in the Know and KY Reads, which provides professional learning to teachers about dyslexia. She was the first active teacher in Kentucky to ever serve on the Kentucky Board of Education as an ex officio non-voting member. She is married to Jason Stone for 23 years and has two children, Jaden, 21, and Will, 16. We welcome Allison to Education Perspectives. So Allison Sloan, so very glad to have you here on Education Perspectives. Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be here.
Well, again, so great to have you. And we'll kick you off with the big question. 30,000 foot view, why do you think that we as a society invest in education?
Because knowledge is power and knowledge is growth and knowledge is becoming what you want to be in this world and what we need in this world. So I think we invest in education because we know that in order for our society to thrive, in order for it to grow and to continue figuring out the world around us, we have to have an educated society so that we can not just learn the things that we learn in school while we're there, but that we can learn how to learn. And I think that's the most important part of education is learning how to learn.
Isn't that the truth? That's a great answer. So you are now involved in education in a multiple different ways. Mm-hmm. What drew you to education in the first place?
I'm going to give you one of those answers that so many teachers give you, but I've always wanted to be a teacher. I never had desire to be anything other than that. As a child growing up, I was one of those little girls that played school with her stuffed animals and her doll babies, and I taught them how to read and write and do all of those things. And then as I got a little older, my dad married a lady who was a second grade teacher. And so that just continued the inspiration. I watched her. I worked in her classroom. As I got older, I developed lessons even for her summer school kids, and she would take me with her, and I could teach children in small groups. I got to do her bulletin boards, and you know, she really, really encouraged and inspired me as an educator. And then as a senior in high school, she got a little worried maybe she'd encouraged me too much, and I started finding pamphlets for pharmacy school around the house, and I was like, no, I don't want to do that. And she was like, but I'm just so afraid I may have just made you want to be a teacher. No, my heart is a teacher. That's exactly what I've always wanted to be and why I'm here, because my heart is still a teacher.
You know, I think so many people in education, they really do have that calling. And it's a gift. It's a gift to our society that you're willing to share that with students. So
thank you.
So that's a great segue into, I know that you are a special education teacher.
Yes.
What do you absolutely love about what you do?
What do I absolutely love about what I do? First and foremost are the students. To see their growth, to see them learning, to see them become what they want to become, to see them learn how to learn, because that's the ultimate gift, as I said earlier, is leaving and sending them out into the world with the ability of knowing how to find information and how to ask questions and how to question the things around them that, you know, they want to change. I think that's something that I try to instill in my children, is you don't have to accept it the way it is, and that there's a right way and a wrong way to change the world around you and how to go about doing that. But it's also the other educators, which is what I've kind of found in the last 10 years of my career is, you know, the seeing other educators learn how to deal with my students and how to teach my students and how to modify and change their, not only their teaching and their instruction in the classroom, but their frame of mind around how children learn differently. That's always such a plus. And when I see that in another teacher, and when they come to me and they've changed the way they look at how the lesson's supposed to go to meet the needs of my students, that's when I have a great day, because then I've not only taught students, but I've taught other adults how to help my students.
Oh, that is marvelous. And I can see that aha moment just being incredibly rewarding. That is so neat. Well, you also are involved. You are the founder of a Facebook group that I have come to know and love. Although I'm not a teacher, I follow it fairly religiously. It's called Kentucky Teachers in the Know. And a huge part of the discussion online among educators has a lot to do with the retention and recruitment of teachers. Can you tell me a little bit about what inspired you to start the group, what you hope to get out of it?
Sure, I'd love to. So a lot of people think, because it's my group, Kentucky Teachers, and it started right around the time that the discussion around our pension and the lack of better words, the fight for our pension started. So a lot of people just seem to assume that that's why I started the group, but it really wasn't. I actually started a month or two before that discussion kind of hit the fan, for lack of better words. I became bigger in teacher leadership and got involved in a lot more things outside of my classroom just by chain of events, pretty much. And I started seeing the world of things available for teachers, resources, conferences, camaraderie between teachers, and that leadership world that I realized teachers are in their classrooms every day and they're doing their jobs, but they don't always know about all the things going on in the education world around them. So I really was just trying to tag a bunch of teachers on Facebook one day in a post about a conference coming up because I wanted them to know about it. And Facebook wouldn't let me do that. I kept saying it was too many people. So I thought, well, I'll just start a small group for, you know, my couple hundred teacher friends that I know in the state of Kentucky and add them to that group. That way I can share about conferences and resources and things that I'm learning about in my adventures as a teacher leader. And then the pension crisis happened. And so I started sharing information about that and people started messaging me, can I add my friend to the group? They really need to know about this. Can I add this? And within about 4 or 5 months, we were at 10,000 members because it was a time when teachers were craving more information. And it was really the perfect storm as far as being able to grow the group that was not my intentions when I started it, to be the administrator to a group of now 27,000 plus educators and legislators and media personnel and all kinds of decision makers in the education world are members of this group now. Administrators, superintendents, lots of various people, stakeholders in the education world. That was my goal in the beginning, but on a much smaller scale, of course. I never dreamed in a million years this would happen, but it has opened doors to many possibilities and many avenues, not just for myself, but for educators as well. And I hear stories from people all the time of, you know, that I found my job through Kentucky Teachers in the Know, or I learned about this through the site, or it helped me get through this, you know, battle that I was having, you know, crisis in my career or whatever. But it's, you know, and we've done lots of, you know, we do conferences now. We put on our own conference every year and just various things. We help educators. We raise money for people in need that are in the education world. And when like disasters like the flooding and the tornadoes happened, we did a lot of fundraising around that. So we've tried to continue to grow it, not as far as numbers, and that's always great. We love when we get new members, but to grow it as far as how we view the necessity of the group and what we want it to be able to do for our educators. We're always looking for how can we do more and how can we do better for our teachers.
Well, that's really bringing more and more value to it. So that is a great way to continue to grow. I love that whole lifelong leadership piece. And I need to put in there, I'm so very glad to hear that you've got legislators and administrators and whatnot. Because as someone who comes to education from the outside, The discussions around pink slipping,
yes,
absolutely bowled me over. Because for any of you in the audience that don't know, at least the standard practice here in Kentucky is come April, any teachers that don't already have tenure are at risk of being pink slipped, which means they're at risk of being let go. And oftentimes they don't even know if they're going to have a job come August. Mm-hmm. And who wants to stay in that kind of profession? Holy goodness. Mm-hmm. And that seems like a system that we really ought to change given the recruitment and retention types of issues.
That is definitely one of the barriers to retaining teachers and recruiting them, because like you said, nobody wants to think that every year they're going to, you know, possibly lose their job and have to look for a new position. And that happens in many districts, not all of them. The district I happen to be in it's not a normal practice and hasn't been in the 24 years I've been here. It's happened occasionally, but usually there's more to the story or there's something else going on. But some districts make it, you absolutely will be pink slipped every year until you're tenured. It's just a practice. And I've been given lots of various reasons. Sometimes I understand, especially in the larger districts, I've been told it's because that they have to wait to know what the funding allocation is going to be for the next year, because some of the teachers that have been put in other positions may have to go back to the classroom, which means they have to have positions open for them because they do have tenure. So, you know, there's understandably some small reasons, but I think that's very small reasons. And I'm not sure that that means an entire district should have that blanket policy of pink slipping every single year until someone's tenured.
Well, I honestly cannot believe that anybody who wants to retain teachers can think that that's a good policy.
So, I agree.
you can't tell that I'm a little passionate about this particular area, yes. But tell me a little bit more about that kind of whole retention and recruitment of teachers. What do you think that teachers are looking for now if we really want to try to add to the teaching profession and make sure that we have enough teachers, you know, to work with our students? What do you think we need to do?
I think first and foremost, and I think that it's been leading to this, is teachers want a voice. And not just teachers, our instructional assistants, our bus drivers, our cooks, our custodians, they want to have a voice in their profession and what they have to do every day. And yes, and in some jobs, you don't necessarily have a voice. You go to your job, you get told what you're doing, you have a set of expectations and you meet those. But a normal job is not necessarily always a profession. And we've got to start viewing every single person that works in our school system, from the bus driver to the teacher in the classroom, as a professional and an educator, because we could not absolutely do anything in our schools without every one of those positions that are available. We can't have school if the bus drivers aren't bringing the kids to us. If we can't feed the children, we're not having school. You know, it takes all of us together. So we've got to start viewing it as a profession, and we've got to start listening to people and not just making decisions based on what we think is best for all those people in that position, but letting them have a say and letting them be heard in that. And I think that's where you've seen this shift. Is, like I mentioned earlier, knowledge is power. And in the last, I would say, 7 to 8 years, maybe a little longer, teachers have been getting more involved outside the classroom. Teacher leadership became an actual thing. And that's where, you know, we started learning about all of those things that are going on outside our classroom. Because what we do as educators is we walk into school every day, we lock the doors behind us to the outside world. We walk in our classroom, we literally lock the door again behind us in the classroom, and we do our job. But our profession requires so much more than what we do behind that closed door. And so, as teachers, instructional assistants, and superintendents, and principals, and people started learning more about what was going on outside those doors that impact what's happening inside those doors with policy, with decisions made at the state level, decisions made at the federal level, even decisions made in the office down the hallway by their principal and other people, that knowledge, the more we know, the more powerful we are, in that we know now what's going on, and we want to have a say in it, and we understand better. So that knowledge is power. And so therefore, when you're not feeling like you're being heard, and you don't feel like you're being given a chance to have a voice in what your profession should look like, what your daily task should look like, then you start looking at other avenues. You start looking at other things that you can do that will give you that feeling of being a professional, a feeling of being heard and being respected and valued. So the top reasons that we can't get teachers to go to school, we're having less and less people going to college to even become teachers. And I tell people this all the time. As a matter of fact, I wrote a big post about it the other day. What other profession are the future people of that profession watching them 5 days a week from 8 a.m. till 3:30 p.m. do the job that they someday want to do? Or may want to do. Children are not sitting in a doctor's office every day of their life growing up watching doctors. They're not sitting in an auto body shop watching mechanics work on cars every single day of their life. But they're sitting in our classrooms. They see how we're being treated by other students. They see how we're being treated by administration. They see all of the tasks that we're supposed to do and implement every day. And then they see us going to the meetings after the school day ends. They see us at the football games. They see us at the dances. They see all of these things. And they see the frustration. They see the teachers that are tired. They see that and they think, I don't know that I want to do that. So that's what we're hearing. I teach at a high school level, and that's what I hear from a lot of students at the high school level, is I don't want to have to do what you have to do every day. And you don't get paid enough for that. You know, so that brings in the next thing. So it's how not being listened to is the third biggest reason, how we're being treated, the more and more being asked of us. but we're not being compensated for it. And then student behavior, you know, it was increasing before COVID, but after COVID, student behavior is not well. Students are not well. They're not well mentally. There's a lot of trauma in their lives that we didn't have necessarily, our generation didn't growing up. Many, many children do not have that family dynamic that taught them the things our parents and grandparents taught us. So all of those things those people taught us, we're now being expected to teach. And they're putting all of that more and more hats on the teachers. Well, you need to teach them life skills. You need to dress appropriately so they learn how to dress appropriately when they go out in the real world. You need to learn how to teach them how to speak. You need to teach them how to do this. Those are things my family taught me. Mm-hmm. And my teachers taught me content. I didn't expect them to be the ones to teach me how to be an adult, but we're having to teach them everything, plus help them learn to deal with the trauma and the mental health issues that they're bringing with them to school. And it's starting at much and much younger age, and our teachers are being physically assaulted, verbally threatened. It's happening more and more all the time. And the students see that. So again, you go back to they're seeing the teachers being treated that way, and they don't want to grow up and do that. So until we can get that under control, that's a whole other issue. But we're also, when you put all of that together and you think about all of that, some of us, like myself, I'm still a teacher. Like I said, my heart is a teacher heart. I am a teacher. And I'm so far invested. There's, you know, what else am I going to do at this point, even if I wanted to? But with that said, now that I know more and that knowledge is power, I realize I need to be compensated for what I'm doing. It's no longer just I'm meant to be a teacher, so I'm going to go be a teacher. I don't care that I'm not paid what I probably should be because I love my job. That sounds great. And it's wonderful. And there are still lots of us that feel that way. But again, we have the knowledge now that it could be different. And we should be different. It should be different for us. And we are not being compensated the way that we should be. So you have a lot of children now that look at that and they say, I can take my knowledge and I love science. I'm going to go over here and be a chemist and I'm going to make way more money than you are as a teacher. Or I'm going to go work in the bourbon industry and I'm going to make a lot more money than you are as a teacher. So we've got to realize that none of those other things are possible without our teachers.
Yeah.
So until we value our teachers, and when I say teachers, I really should say educators. I try to do that because it's everyone in our building. Until we value all educators and all people working with our children, we do have a crisis on our hands because not only are they not coming into the profession, they're leaving at astronomical rates. So when people are leaving at astronomical rates and you don't have enough people going into it behind them to fill those positions, then you have hundreds and sometimes thousands of unfilled positions in our state. And we're a month, almost 2 months into the school year. And there are a lot of teaching positions that have not been filled.
Well, and I think that the entirety of the system needs a real reality check. You know, I look at teachers like yourself who've been in the classroom for years and years. They basically are, there's no career path for people who are directly in contact and teaching in the classroom. And so finding new ways to be able to compensate teacher leadership outside of the classroom, compensate those that are taking the leadership in professional development, helping PLCs and doing what you're doing as far as helping to grow the camaraderie within the profession. Those are systems that can change. And our leaders need to take serious looks at that because you all are professionals. And, you know, their answer seems to have been, oh, we're just going to give them every little tiny resource and micromanage them to death. And that's like the opposite of what teachers need.
Exactly. And you hit on a very good point. So many times in our profession, we've started hearing the talk of compensating teachers more based on what they do. So we need math teachers more because we're not getting math teachers. So we're going to pay them more. Or we need special education teachers, so we're going to pay them more. Or, hey, let's compensate teachers who have the best test scores. Those are not the way to compensate teachers because then you start combating teachers against teachers. You know, because if I find out the math teacher got hired with a $10,000 bonus because we really needed to fill that math position. And I get that. But then I'm over here and I'm being beaten black and blue by a student every day because I have a child that cannot regulate themselves because they're not figured that out yet. Then why am I not getting the extra $10,000? So you're pitting people against each other, and that's not okay. But what you can do is exactly what you said. If you want to start paying people based on their value, and their value may be that they are leading PLCs for their team for that year, then they should be compensated more for doing that extra leadership task. Or you give them and find ways for teachers to be leaders. If you've got someone and you see some kind of talent in them for leadership, but like myself, I have a special education degree. I have a special education bachelor's degree, a special education master's degree, and a special education rank one, because I also didn't have someone in my university who really guided me well to get something, because at that time I didn't think I wanted to do anything outside the classroom. But now here I am 24 years into it, and I do wish I had something else. And I see my path as a teacher leader, but that still doesn't mean I necessarily want to be an administrator or a counselor or something like that. But there's various other ways that I am being a teacher leader, and I'm doing lots of things that are leadership roles, but I'm not getting paid anything for that. That's not okay either. You know, many of them are my choice, and that's on me. But there's ways to value and use the skills of your educators. We are doing more and more in some districts. I think several districts are getting on board with using our own people to provide professional learning. Mm-hmm. We have lots of professionals in our own districts that are so well educated and so good at what they do on various levels and in various different topics. And so we're using those people more to provide the professional learning that we're requiring in our districts, but we're also not paying them anymore for that in many ways.
I have to give a shout out to Fayette County Public Schools. I recently came on board as a communications consultant with them, with their Department of Innovation, and they are actually doing that in their deeper learning initiative, and they are elevating people. And I was at a meeting last week where they were doing asset mapping with the original teachers. Okay, what can you do and what can you offer that your administrators might not even know about? Mm-hmm. And I thought, what a wonderful way to start that visioning. And yeah, and it's probably grant funding that won't come back again, but they are compensating all the teachers for that. And I just think that that's a great step forward. So I have to give them a shout out.
We have to start changing the mindset as well. There's still kind of an old school mindset around school of that those in administration are the leaders. And everyone else is below them. And there's a chain of command and you have to follow and you need to stay in your lane kind of mentality. And there's a mentality of, and not all of them, there are some, don't get me wrong, there are many wonderful administrators across our state, but there are still a lot of people in those administrative roles that want to push the people down below them because they're fearful. And the only thing I can figure out is they're fearful that it will make them look like they're not doing their job. If someone below them, a teacher or an instructional assistant or someone is playing in a leadership role or is doing things or sharing ideas that are different than maybe the way it's been done, then they don't like that. And that's why a lot of those teacher leaders and people get to the point where they don't speak up because they don't feel valued. They don't feel heard. And then they're basically told their idea is not any good because someone else, it's about credit and all this stuff. That's where we've got to change the mentality. It is a village for sure that takes all of us to educate these children. And I'm one of these people, I always give credit where credit is due. If it was my idea, great. If it was somebody else's idea, then I want you to get the credit. I want you to be told what a wonderful idea that is, because that's how you grow leaders, is you have to value what they bring to the table, because if you don't, then they stop bringing stuff to the table, and that's not okay.
And they're also not going to be as engaged in wanting to be the best teachers that they can be. And so I find it very sad with these protectionist leaders that they don't realize that if you empower and encourage your people that are under you, they will make you look good. They will make you look so much better. And that's what a great leader does. So yeah, no, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
It's very sad. And I think it's kind of like culture in one school. It is culture within a school, culture within a district, culture within a state, it takes time. It takes time, and it takes more and more people willing to speak up, even if it means going against the grain, even if it means possibly getting a little backlash and a pushback. We have to continue. And I've had that pushback. I know what that feels like. And so when people come to me and they'll say, oh, I can't do that. I'm afraid, you know, this and that. I'm like, but you have to. You have to push a little bit sometimes. And it's okay. And if you will hit brick walls, when I hit brick walls, it just means I got to find another way around that wall. You know, it can be done, but you have to just carry on. And it takes time.
You know, and it is worth pointing out to those that are fearful that part of our system that really needs to change for students is that culture of fear has got to go away. And that culture of fear of failure has got to go away, because what employers need today are folks that can try, fail, readjust, reiterate, and move forward. And frankly, we're preparing them for jobs that don't even exist yet. So it's no longer about content. It's about process and ability to think and ability to handle it when some obstacle comes in front of them. And you are modeling that for your students with what you're doing. And so
thank you.
I, for one, am so proud of you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Getting back to your students a little bit, you mentioned in your notes and whatnot a little bit about dyslexia. My husband actually suffered from dyslexia, so I would love to hear what you have to say about that.
Sure. So as a special ed teacher, sadly, will admit that several years of my beginning of my profession, I was told that it didn't really exist. It wasn't real. This is the fight in the edu and medical world on dyslexia has caused a lot of this. When my son was in first grade, as a teacher, I noticed he was struggling, and we started seeing lots of behavioral things happening because of the struggle. And the more he started into getting homework and having to bring home the, you know, the infamous read 5 minutes a night and document it on a piece of paper, or the here's the first 5 spelling words, you know, the spelling list that started coming home. What should have been a 10-minute, 15-minute thing in our home became 2 and 3 hours of complete meltdowns. So as a mama and as a teacher, I knew something wasn't okay. So we started talking to people. I really didn't know what it was. Because I was a special ed teacher, I felt like it wasn't autism, but I did see sensory stuff going on, just different things. We went to our family doctor and she sent us to have an evaluation done. And she put lots of different things on there. Did not have dyslexia on the list of things that none of us, it wasn't even in our realm of thinking, but we went to the Weisskopf Center in Louisville, and the lady, the psychologist, interviewed us for a little while, my husband and I, and then she worked with her son for a couple of hours, and then she brought us back in, and she said, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt. And she looked at me and she said, everything you told me about your child, I knew before I met him what it was. She said, I had no doubt what it was. She said, because you know your kid. And I thought, I don't even know what it is. Like, why? How could you know from what I said? I have no idea. And she said, your son is profoundly dyslexic. And I was in tears. I was bawling because I had been told that wasn't a real thing. And I knew just enough to know that I felt like we were going to hit brick walls. There are those brick walls in education again. And so I became warrior mommy, started learning as much as I could. We got him evaluated at school to see if he qualified for special education services, which he did not, but he did get a 504 plan for some, you know, modifications and accommodations and stuff. But then I started, you know, this was before Kentucky Teachers in the Know. I'm on social media. I'm looking up groups, you know, and I found Decoding Dyslexia had a meeting coming up soon in Northern Kentucky. And I thought, it's a bunch of moms of children with dyslexia. I want to go to this meeting. So my husband and I drove about a couple hours and just went to a meeting to random people. And this is a little small group. And knowing what I know now, I understand how they felt. They kind of was shocked that this person just drove out of nowhere to come find out more. And that led me to meeting people and talking to people and getting involved in things and finding out that, I believe at the time, Representative Wushner was in Kentucky, and she had worked on a bill for dyslexia. She was fighting to get more legislation on dyslexia. So I just kept building on that, started going to like teacher conferences and presenting what little bit I knew about dyslexia. And it was basically, here are the signs and symptoms, because I want you as a teacher to be able to see what it is and recognize it in your classroom. And here are just some little things you could do that will help these children. So I met a lady there who used to be was one of the teachers of the year many years before. And she literally came up to me afterwards and she was like, her name's Sarah. And she was like, you have to do this and you have to do this and you have to do that. And so that led to lots of other wonderful things. But then I found out we were getting a new commissioner at the time, which was Dr. Pruitt. And I went to a Pritchard committee meeting that he was going to be speaking at. And I don't think he'd been here 10 days if he'd been here that long, bless his heart. And so he spoke and my whole goal being there was to meet him, you know, and to say, what are you going to do about dyslexia in Kentucky? And he was like out the door, like he spoke and was out the door. And so I ran him down. We like to joke about it now, but I ran him down in a hotel. So we tell lovely jokes about that. And I introduced myself and I had been taught in my teacher leadership world, you know, your elevators, Bill, you got 2 minutes. What are you going to say? And I said, I'm so-and-so, and here's what I'm a mom, I'm a teacher, and I want to know what you're going to do about dyslexia. And he laughed and he said, I don't think I got off the airplane in Kentucky before someone said, what are you going to do about program reviews and what are you going to do about dyslexia? And I said, well, good. And I handed him my number and I said, then call me. And he called me just a few days later. And here I was a teacher in my classroom on my planning period. And he scheduled a conference call with me. And he said, I've been asked so many questions about dyslexia and I don't know how to answer them because I don't know enough about it myself. He said, so I'm going to ask you the questions. Can you give me the answers? And then that way, your answers will become my answers when people ask me about it. Well, I was just starting in teacher leadership world, and you talk about powerful. That was powerful. And so he asked me, and I was even honest with him. I said, I don't even know a whole lot about it. So we devised a plan, a bunch of us mamas and teachers, of how we wanted to put together. We knew just enough about policy at that time that a task force to put together, because I know you can't change policy overnight. And I know that we didn't know enough and we didn't have the data to really be able to back fighting for it. But I researched enough to know that we'd had task force on other things in the past and that maybe that's what we could do. So we put together a plan to come back and ask Dr. Pruitt to do that. And before we could even get our plan together to ask him, he was calling me and asking me if I would be on a dyslexia task force. So we did that for a year. It was an amazing experience. We put together a plan, basically an ask, a big old document. He said, ask for it all. He said, you know, you're not going to get it all, but ask for it all. And then we will do what we can do, but shoot for the stars. And that meant a lot. You know, I was still learning him and learning who he was and then still learning what a commissioner of education was. I didn't know a whole lot at that time. So the last 10 years of my life have been really fast and furious and learning a lot about teacher world. But we did. We took our recommendations and Dr. Pruitt and his team of people at Kentucky Department of Ed basically turned that into legislation and presented it. And went back then to Dr. Wooshner and Representative Wooshner and a lot of people. And we started then really fighting to get laws changed. We still don't have the best and we're still working on it, but it's come a long way and there's toolkits. Dyslexia is a household and a classroom word now where it wasn't before. And no one is really saying, is it real or it isn't real anymore? We're saying, what are we going to do about it? And that's a huge difference. And then we're realizing too that it's a huge difference. It's huge. And we realized in the process of all of this that the way we were teaching reading wasn't good for most students. You know, we'd gone through this whole world of whole language that if you just expose them to it, they're going to learn how to read. And that's how I was taught as a special ed teacher to teach reading. Just expose them to it. I had no phonetics training. I had no phonology training. None of that. And I'm supposed to be working with the most difficult and children with the biggest deficits in reading, and I don't know how to teach them how to read. So then we start looking at all that, and the Department of Ed starts doing that, and we start talking to people in other states who have really hit reading instruction hard, and then we start learning about the science of reading. So now in Kentucky, we kind of shifted, not really changed our focus on dyslexia, but really shifted into how do we change how we teach reading in our schools. And that will help a lot of our children, whether they ever know they have dyslexia or not. This will change a lot of children's work because literacy in general for all children was not well in Kentucky. So now thousands and thousands of our teachers are being taught about the science of reading and going back to the five big components of literacy instruction and not just thinking we immerse them in words and they're going to learn how to do it. So we're really starting with that K-3 and teaching teachers how to teach reading. And I think that's going to be just astronomical. I can't wait. It'll take a while for us to see the changes, but I think 10 to 15 years from now, we're going to start seeing such a difference in reading and children's ability to be literate and to go out in the world, because if they can't read, they can't do anything.
Exactly.
To the best of their ability, you know? But it's amazing to watch these children as they learn and they grow. And my son is now a junior, so we've come a long way, and he's doing great. He still doesn't like school, but, you know, that's on him. But, you know, we've come a long way. So, yeah, that was my big thing. We did develop a group called Kentucky Reads. A bunch of us did that. We go around and we present to teachers at conferences, and I've been hired by schools to come in and talk about dyslexia. And then that was my first Facebook group. And Kentucky Reads, and we don't post a whole lot in it anymore because we're kind of to the point now that our goal has been met, that teachers know about it, they are aware of it, they know the signs and symptoms. They still reach out sometimes and say, I've got this kid and I really think they may have dyslexia. Who do I connect with and what do I need to look for? So that's always a good moment when we can help connect them to people.
What an amazing advocacy journey.
And really, and none of it meant to happen. It just happened. Yeah.
And, you know, I love that it came from you as a mom and you as a teacher, because those two different perspectives really, really can help to move things forward. I was very involved in PTA. That was my entry point to education. And so many parents that I met had some sort of a challenge that they couldn't get over, and they didn't feel like they were being heard and that sort of thing. And so I spent a lot of time teaching about advocacy and how the system works and all that kind of stuff. And so that was just so inspiring to me. Way to go.
Well, and you know, as a teacher of children with special needs is one thing. I always felt like I had a big heart for those children, and I really tried to help the parents understand. But when I became a mother of a child with a special need, it completely changed my perspective, you know, I was great before as far as my children were concerned, but to understand it from a parent's point of view. So now when I'm in those meetings, I always, 100% of the time, always when I meet a new parent, say, hey, my kid has dyslexia. My kid has sensory processing disorder. My kid has ADHD. I live and breathe at school with your child all day, and I go home with my own kid and live and breathe what you're breathing at home every day. So I get you. I get you not from a teacher perspective. I get you from a mama perspective. And so please know that I see it from your point of view as well. And it changes you can see the air just flow out of them then, that they feel more comfortable. They realize that I'm not there as that other adult that seems to know more than them. And so I try to coach other adults into that are in the meeting as well, is that the parent knows they're the expert on their kid. We're the expert on how to help their kid while they're at school, or the expert on the content, but they are the expert on their child. And we have to make them feel just like we want to feel valued. They have to feel valued as well.
You know, you keep giving me chills during this discussion. That's really, but I mean, it is. And especially, you know, so many of the parents that I worked with on, you know, that had kids with special needs, they mm-hmm. don't fit into the system as it's designed. And, you know, even if you go to the absolute best schools, mm-hmm. you know, yes. the ones that have the great scores and all this kind of stuff, those kids, you can't approach it the same way. The system doesn't work for them that way. And it needs to be modified. Oh, that's so cool. You've already told me lots of great stories, but tell me, do you have a favorite memory about your work in education?
Oh, goodness. There's so many. And sometimes they'll just pop at random times. And then I can't think of them when I want to. I'll tell you one that was recent that still just really tugs at my heart. And I've shared this with lots of people. I have, you know, I'm at the high school level now. So I've been at all the levels. I was middle school the most, and I thought I would start there and go there till I died probably, but I didn't. And that's okay, because now that I've seen all different levels, it's given me a new perspective. And I kind of like that too. But high school level is different in that they're like little adults. They still want a sticker if they're, you know, if they've done something good. They love to get a smelly sticker, and it's just great. But they sometimes come with adult problems and adult worlds that they live in, when we still look at them as being children, and we forget that sometimes. So I was at school one morning, and I had just found out that a former student of mine passed away from a drug overdose. I had heard the situation, but I didn't know who it was. And so just before walking into my first period class, I found out who it was. And I always wait outside my classroom, and I greet my children at the door. And they sometimes will stand and talk to me, because they have about 10 minutes between bells to kind of walk around and visit with their friends and stuff. And they'll sometimes stop and talk. And I have a student who had also gone through some problems with drugs, drug abuse, selling drugs, those kind of things, and had gone through some therapies and stuff, and is doing amazing, doing absolutely amazing. I was so proud of this child, but they recognized I was upset. I was trying to hold it in, trying my best not to let it show, you know, and this child came up to me and he said, asked if I was okay. And I said, I'm not okay. I said, thank you for recognizing that. And I said, I just found out that a former student of mine, one of my very first students, had passed away from a drug overdose. And this child looked at me and he said, Ms. Sloan, he said, I know how you're feeling. He said, when I was in therapy, I met a lot of people that were going through what I went through. He said, but they didn't all make it. He said, so I lost a lot of people that I had just made friends with. He said, to the same thing that you've experienced. He said, so I know how that feels. And when that was powerful enough to know that he'd been through some really adult level things, he then looked at me and he said, Ms. Sloan, you've always got me. He said, today I've got you. Oh, Lord. I said, well, if I wasn't crying already, I am now. He just smiled and he hugged me and went on to class, but he checked on me several times throughout the day just to see if I was okay. And then I saw his mom a couple of days later and I said, I have to tell you what he did. And she said, you don't have to tell me. He came home and told me that he had you that day. And I was like, oh, okay, now I'm crying again. But those are the moments you know, it's not always about the content. It's not always about whether they figured out, you know, figure out that math equation, or they know about, you know, wells in the ocean, or that they figured out how to spell that hard word, because I still can't spell well either. And that's okay. But it's that going back to learning how to learn.
Yes.
And he had learned something that in his world was compassion, and he gave it back. And you know, and in him doing that, I learned that my children, my students, who I still very much call my children, were adults in a lot of ways. And they had sometimes experienced things that in my 47 years, I had never experienced.
Yeah.
That was eye-opening for me. I thought, I got to remember that sometimes they're experiencing things that I have never experienced. And that was a powerful moment for me. So we both learned a lot from each other that day in a matter of something that was a conversation that lasted maybe a minute.
But will have lifelong impact. That's just, you gave me chills again.
Yeah. And I also told his mother, if he ever disappeared, not to look at my house, because I would steal him. But, you know, she's very well aware that he would probably be at my house.
Well, you know, that speaks to the power of relationships. And that's when the real learning happens, is when you have a relationship with a student to where they can trust you and they feel like you have their back and that they want to have your back.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so much right about that story.
There is. And, you know, and I want teachers to also understand that it's okay that if you can't build that relationship with children. There have been, in my 24 years of teaching, children that I just could not. And some of those still haunt me to this day. But I also have to remind myself that it's okay to say, I can't, but let's find the other adult that can. Let's make sure there's someone this child can feel comfortable with, you know, and try every avenue. And then there will still be some children at the end of the day that just don't bond with people and just don't, for whatever reason. But it doesn't mean you give up.
Yes.
And again, it might not be you, but it might be someone else. And sometimes as teachers, that's hard, you know, because I've got children this year I didn't have last year, but I knew them. So, you know, today I got a text from one of my coworkers and they said, so-and-so wants me to come speak to them. And I was like, a little heartbroken. I was like, they're in my room right now. Why don't they want to talk to me? You know, but then I have to remember they've already bonded with that person. And that's something we're going to work on through the year. So it's okay to, sometimes we feel like failures when we can't get to all of them, but there's a lot of them. And we just have to try. And if you can make the difference in two or three lives, then that's two or three lives that you made the difference in.
Absolutely. And planting the seed makes a big difference. And the other thing is that having multiple adults in their lives is a good thing. I think about, I mean, I'm empty nesting right now. And I found myself kind of going, well, my daughter's calling my husband about, you know, some things with the veterinary world and whatnot. And I'm just like, well, she's not calling me. And then I had to check myself and say, well, wait a second. That's so cool that she has a strong relationship with her dad and she has things that he can help to support her with. So, yeah, I feel that pain, but I agree with you. I think that it's back to that. It takes a village. You know, it may not be you. It may be, you know, for my son, it happened to be the PE teacher in elementary school that really helped him to turn a corner on a challenge that he had. And, you know,
I got a new student not those last year, and I noticed on their talking about transition stuff and what they wanted to be as an adult, this child had put custodian. And I was like, okay, that's great. Absolutely nothing wrong with wanting to be a custodian. But I just, there was something about it. And so I started asking questions. This child had been through the foster care system, and in another school, the custodian had been the kind person, had reminded them of someone in their biological family. And so that inspired them to want to someday be a custodian. So, you know, it can, we're all educators in our own way in our buildings. And that's what we've got to remember too.
Isn't that the truth? Well, geez, Allison, I could speak to you all day, but we are coming hard on our 30 to 40 minutes here. But I would love to, as a final question, ask, what would you like decision makers to know? One or two things.
I think that I want decision makers, because there's lots of decision makers. And in some ways, we are decision makers as well. And so I think I want decision makers to know that they are important and they are valued, but they are not the only voice in what we do every day. And that we have to listen to all the voices and all the ideas to come to a consensus on what's best for our children. And sometimes what's best for our students means we have to take care and do what's best for the educators.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're the ones taking care of the students. So I think it's knowing that they're important, their voice is important, but they're not the only voice. And we've got to listen to all of them.
That is a fantastic answer to that question. And I appreciate your time so very, very much. And thank you for all you're doing in support of the students with dyslexia and reading initiatives and Kentucky Teachers in the Know. And good on you for all of this great work that you're sharing with the world.
I appreciate that so much. And I appreciate you doing this. And I've noticed the list of people you've been talking to and some of the podcast and some great people. So I appreciate you letting their voices be heard.
Awesome. In that case, maybe you'll post it on Kentucky Teachers in the Know. I'd love to have more listeners.
I will definitely do that.
Well, thank you so very much.
Thank you, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Education Perspectives. Feel free to share your thoughts on our Facebook page. Let us know which education perspectives you would like to hear or share. Please subscribe and share with your friends.